Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are doing something a little specific today because if you look at the calendar, today is actually a significant date. It's February 11th, 2026.
Which, if my math holds up, marks exactly 25 years of practice for Wolf Architects.
Exactly. 25 years. Now, in some industries, like, I don't know, banking or law, yeah. 25 years is just getting started.
You're just hitting your stride.
But in the design world, in high-end creative work, that feels like a lifetime.
It is a lifetime. Architecture has a notoriously high burnout rate.
Right.
It's a field where you are constantly balancing massive budgets, huge egos, strict regulations, and, you know, the laws of physics.
So to survive a quarter century is one thing.
To thrive and stay relevant, that is a whole different beast.
And that is the mission for this deep dive. We aren't just here to look at pictures of pretty houses, though we will talk about the design. We have a stack of their blog archives here. Everything from their philosophical manifestos like The Eye and Mind of the Wolf to their fairly aggressive stance on the construction industry and even their take on AI. We want to unpack the survival strategy.
Right. How do you maintain a design obsession, and those are their words, not mine, for 25 years without going crazy or, you know, selling out?
And just to hook you in, listener, some of the stats we found in these archives are wild. Mm-hmm. We are talking about a firm that claims to turn away 90% of the people who try to hire them.
The famous 1 in 10 rule.
Yeah. Which, from a business perspective, sounds absolutely insane. Mm. Imagine a restaurant turning away 9 out of 10 people at the door.
I was going to say.
We're going to get into why they do that and why you think it's actually the secret to their longevity.
It sounds counterintuitive, but I think it's the only way this specific business model works.
Okay, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's start with the milestone itself. February 11th, 2026. The blog post is titled 1,000 Images, 1 Million Words. It's a retrospective.
It is. They're looking back at over 200 built works.
I want to pause on that number. 200 built works in 25 years. Is that a lot? Because if I'm a commercial developer, I'm building 200 units in a month.
Right. But you have to look at the context. These aren't cookie-cutter apartments.
No.
These are bespoke, luxury, custom residential projects. A single house at this level isn't a six-month build.
It's much longer.
It's often a 3, 4, or even 5-year journey from the first sketch to the client moving in.
So the logistics are heavy.
The logistical load is immense. To average roughly 8 finished high-spec projects a year, every single year, for 25 years.
Wow.
That requires a level of operational discipline that most creative firms just don't have. It's not just about drawing, it's about execution.
They describe this journey in the text as countless ideas turn into places people live, work, and escape. But what jumped out at me is that you really can't separate this firm from its location.
No, you can't.
We need to talk about Sydney.
Absolutely. The blog post, What It Means to Be a Sydney Architect, is crucial here.
They describe Sydney as visually powerful and globally recognized. They call it Australia's international face.
And that's not just hometown pride. Mm. Sydney presents a very specific challenge to an architect. Think about the backdrop.
Okay.
You have the harbor, the opera house, the bridge, those dramatic sandstone cliffs.
Mm.
The environment is loud.
Oh, loud.
Visually loud. If you build a mediocre beige box in a quiet suburb, nobody really notices.
It just blends in.
It blends in. But if you build a mediocre house on a cliff in Sydney, the landscape mocks you. You're competing with one of the most beautiful natural harbors in the world.
So the stakes are higher just by virtue of the zip code.
The text explicitly says that designing in Sydney means competing on a global stage. The standard is set by international expectations.
So you're not just up against the guy down the street.
No. You're competing with a global idea of what a dream home should look like.
Speaking of dream homes, they have a post titled Forever Dream Homes, where they argue that Australia is the best place on earth to build one.
It's a bold claim, but they back it up with a lifestyle argument.
They call building a dream home a once-in-a-lifetime event. And honestly, that phrase, it sounds nice, but it also sounds terrifying. Once in a lifetime.
It shifts the psychology completely.
But if I buy a car and I don't like it, I trade it in 3 years later.
Sure.
If I build my forever home and I mess it up, that's it. I'm stuck with my mistake for 30 years.
That is exactly the pressure cooker these architects live in.
Yeah.
The source material suggests that when a client comes to them, they aren't just asking for a shelter.
No.
They're asking the architect to design their future. You are predicting how a family will want to live in 10, 20 years.
That sounds exhausting.
It is high pressure. Mm. And I think that pressure is what necessitates the very specific, almost rigid philosophy that we see in the next document.
Let's go there. The eye and mind of the Wolf-If. This is basically their manifesto. And I have to say, reading this, it felt a little bit like a slap in the face to the rest of the industry.
In what way?
Well, usually if you look at architecture marketing, the big buzzwords are sustainability, comfort, emotion.
The holy trinity of modern building.
Everyone promises that. But Wolf writes, and I'm quoting here, across Australia, many architects promise comfort, emotion, and sustainability. At Wolf Architects, we see these things as basics.
It is a massive flex.
Mm-hmm.
But intellectually, it's a very important distinction.
Break it down for me, because to a layman, sustainability sounds like a pretty good end goal.
Okay, think of it this way. If you go to a Michelin star restaurant, you assume the food is safe to eat.
Right, I hope so.
You assume the kitchen is clean. You assume the ingredients are fresh.
Mm-hmm.
But if the chef came out and said, our specialty is that our food doesn't give you food poisoning, you'd be unimpressed.
I would be very unimpressed.
That is the baseline. That is the minimum requirement to be a restaurant.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Wolf is arguing that sustainability, you know, energy ratings, thermal mass, all that compliance, that is just the food safety.
It's the entry ticket.
It's the entry ticket. If your house falls down or if it freezes in winter or if it costs a fortune to heat, you aren't an architect, you're negligent.
So if those are just the basics, what is the actual art for them? What's the Michelin star part?
They define it as things that feel right. And I know that sounds vague, but they break it down into specific elements. Light, proportion, and space.
Respecting light. It sounds poetic, almost a bit pretentious. Does it actually matter that much?
It matters more than almost anything else.
Mm.
Light is a material. It's not just about punching a hole in a wall and calling it a window.
Right.
It's about calculating the angle of the sun at 4.0 p.m. in July versus 4.0 p.m. in January.
Give me a concrete example.
Okay, imagine a living room. If you just put a big window facing west, because there's a view, in the Australian summer, that room becomes a microwave in the afternoon. You can't sit there. You have to close the blinds. So you've lost the view and the light. That is a failure of eye and mind.
Even if the window is, you know, sustainable double glazed glass.
Exactly. The basic is the glass. The art is knowing where to put it so the light hits a textured wall and creates a mood rather than just hitting your TV screen and creating glare.
They also talk about proportion. It should always feel right.
That's the mind part. Have you ever walked into a room and it just felt off?
Oh, yeah.
Like the ceiling was slightly too low for the width of the room, or the hallway felt like a tunnel?
Yeah, it's like wearing a suit that's two sizes too big. It covers you, but it feels wrong.
Perfect analogy. Wolf is saying that the basics cover you. The design is the tailoring. It's the difference between a house that keeps the rain out and a house that makes you feel calmer the moment you walk through the door.
They also mention context. They say contemporary architecture must respect its context while still making a statement. Isn't that a contradiction? Fit in, but stand out.
It is the central tension of the job.
Right.
If you respect context too much, you're camouflaged.
Hmm.
You're boring. If you make too much of a statement, you're the weirdo on the block that everyone hates.
You're hunting for that razor's edge.
They are hunting for that razor's edge in the middle.
Okay, so we have the philosophy. We have the eye in mind. But philosophy is cheap. Building houses is expensive and messy.
Extremely messy.
And this is where I want to challenge them a bit, because for all this talk of art and light, they seem incredibly rigid, almost aggressive about the business side.
Mm.
Specifically, the relationship between the architect and the builder.
You're looking at the post. Why keeping architects and builders separate is in your best interest.
Yeah, they practically draw a battle line. They say in Australia there are regulations about keeping these roles separate, but they want to extend that to the architect. Why is this such a sticking point for them?
It comes down to incentives. This is the classic fox guarding the hen house scenario.
Unpack that.
Okay.
Yeah.
A builder's incentive, generally speaking, is efficiency. They want to finish the job on time, on budget, and move to the next one. They want things to be buildable, standard, and low risk.
Makes sense. That's how they make money.
Right. But the architect's incentive, especially Wolf's incentive, is the vision. It's that tricky lighting detail. It's that custom joinery.
Expensive stuff.
And the difficult stuff. Now, let's say there's a detail where the glass meets the stone floor. It looks amazing, but it's really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
It takes 3 days of labor.
The builder looks at that and says, let's just use a standard frame. It's cheaper, it's faster, and the client probably won't even notice.
Exactly. Now, if the architect works for the builder, what we call design and construct, the architect might get overruled.
The vision gets diluted.
The builder says, change the detail. And the vision gets diluted, death by a thousand cuts.
Right.
Precisely. But if the architect works directly for the client, independent of the builder, they can stand on site and say, no, that detail is essential.
They're the bad cop.
They're the client's insurance policy against mediocrity. Wolf is arguing that you need that friction. You need someone fighting for the art, or the efficiency will win every time.
This rigorous, almost combative approach to quality control, it really explains that statistic we teased at the start.
The 1 in 10.
The rejection rate. In the post, inside the Wolf Architects process, they admit they only take on about 10% of the inquiries they get. Now, I have to play devil's advocate here. Is this just snobbery? Is this just, we are Wolf Architects, we are too cool for you?
It's so easy to read it that way. But if you look at the post, something big is happening at Wolf where they reflect on their history. I think it's actually a survival mechanism.
How so?
They talk about realizing that luxury isn't just about beautiful things. It's about the right things created in the right way.
Okay.
Think about the marriage aspect we discussed.
Right.
The 3 to 5 year commitment.
Right.
If you're an architect who cares deeply about light and proportion, that's your life's work. And you take on a client who just wants a big mansion to impress neighbors.
That's a bad marriage.
It's a disaster. The client will fight you on every decision. Why is this window here? Why can't we use the cheap tile? It drains the firm.
I see.
Wolf is saying that if the client doesn't buy into the eye and mind philosophy from day one, the project is doomed.
So by saying no to the 90%, they are protecting the energy they need for the 10%.
Exactly. It's quality control at the source. You cannot bake a Michelin star cake if you start with bad ingredients. Mm-hmm. And in architecture, the client is the main ingredient.
That is a harsh reality check for anyone looking to hire an architect. You think you're interviewing them, but they're interviewing you.
At this level, absolutely.
I want to pivot to the future. We've looked at the last 25 years, but the archives also look forward. And obviously, we cannot have a conversation about the future of design in 2026 without talking about AI.
The robot in the studio.
They have a post, Wolf Architects versus AI, shaping the future of design. Now, versus is a strong word.
It is.
It sounds like a cage match.
It does. But when you read the text, their stance is actually quite nuanced. They acknowledge the disruption. They see that entire professions are being reshaped.
They say, at Wolf Architects, we have been watching this revolution closely, and we are not just observers.
Not just observers.
Mm-hmm.
That implies active engagement. They aren't Luddites smashing the looms.
But surely AI is a threat to them. I mean, I can go online right now and ask an AI to design me a luxury home in Sydney with a view of the Opera House, and it spits out a stunning image in 4 seconds.
It spits out an image, doesn't spit out a home.
Ah.
And this goes right back to the eye and mind.
How so?
AI is the ultimate tool for the basics. If you want to optimize a floor plan for energy efficiency, AI will beat a human every time.
Sure.
If you want to calculate structural loads, AI is perfect. But.
But.
Can an AI walk onto a site in Sydney, feel the salt spray coming off the ocean, hear the specific frequency of the traffic noise on the road, and know intuitively that the living room needs to pivot 5 degrees to the left to feel calm?
That's the sensory part.
That is the mind. That is the human experience. Wolf seems to be betting that while AI can handle the data, the feeling of a home, the thing that makes it a dream home, is still a strictly human domain.
So they see AI as a tool to handle the boring stuff, leaving them more time to obsess over the light and the proportion.
Exactly. In a world of AI-generated content, true human curation becomes the ultimate luxury. They are betting on humanity remaining the premium product.
Before we wrap up, there was one source in the stack that felt, well, it felt like an oddball.
Let me guess. The running.
Yes. Wolf Architects runs with Melbourne. They sponsored a runner in the Melbourne 10K. We've been talking about high luxury, exclusivity, philosophical manifestos, and then suddenly we're talking about jogging shorts.
It seems disconnected, but I actually think it loops back to their core philosophy perfectly.
Make the connection for me.
Well, look at the commentary in the post. They tie the run back to the idea that great design influences how people live and engage with the world around them. A lot of people, when they think of luxury architecture, they think of a fortress. You drive your Range Rover into the basement garage, the gate closes, and you hide from the world.
The bunker mentality.
Right. But Wolf talks about engagement. A good house shouldn't just be a nice box to hide in. It should improve how you step out into the world.
How you interact with your street, your community.
Exactly. Whether you are running a 10K or just walking out to get a coffee, the architecture of your home sets the stage for that transition. It's about permeability. Even if you are exclusive, you are still a citizen of the city.
That's a really nice way to frame it. The design obsession isn't just about the couch you sit on, it's about the street you live on.
Exactly.
So let's try to land this plane. We've looked at the stats. 25 years, 200 homes, a 1 in 10 client acceptance rate.
Mm.
We've looked at the philosophy treating sustainability as a baseline, not a goal.
And the rigid protection of the design process against the efficiency of the builder.
If you had to distill this down, for your listener who isn't planning to build a $20 million home in Sydney, what is the takeaway here? Why should we care about Wolf Architects?
For me, it's about the definition of standard.
Go on.
Most of us, in our jobs or our lives, we look at the industry standard, what everyone else is doing, and we aim for that. We aim for compliant.
We aim for good enough.
We aim to not get fired.
Right.
Wolf Architects has survived 25 years by looking at the standard and saying, that's the starting line.
Wow.
That's where the work begins. They define their own value, this feeling, this artistry, and then they built a fortress around it.
Right.
They reject clients who threaten it. They fight builders who compromise it. They don't let technology dilute it.
It's the discipline of knowing exactly who you are.
And the courage to say no to everything that isn't that. That is how you survive a quarter of a century.
That is a powerful thought. Makes you look at your own work a little differently.
I have a question for the listener, actually, to leave them with.
Let's hear it.
We talked a lot about how Wolf sees sustainability and comfort as just the basics.
Yeah.
So in your own field, whether you're a coder, a teacher, a manager, a parent, what are the basics that you are patting yourself on the back for?
Oh.
Are you celebrating showing up on time? Are you celebrating just getting the job done? Or are you looking for the light and proportion in your own work? What is your version of the art?
That is going to sting a few people, myself included. I might need to rethink how I write these scripts.
Good. That's the point of a deep dive.
Well, there you have it. Inside the mind of Wolf Architects, 25 years of design obsession. As always, thank you for listening. Whether you're in Sydney looking at the Opera House or just looking out your own window, try to see the basics and then look for what's beyond them. See you next time.